Are we going?
Into podcast.
Potter Who Cast.
But how's it called? Billis Major at your service.
Don't forget me.
Sarah, did you forget me?
Oh, let's go! That's class!
There is no such thing as...
Hello. To quote, is it Stained? I think it's Stained. It's been a while. Is that Stained? That is Stained.
Isn't it? It is. It's the band Stained.
Yeah, it's the band Stained.
It's been a while.
It's been a while. Not Creed or Puddle of Mud or Alien Ant Farm or any of those. Any of those lads. I've listened to a lot of... I have unfortunately fallen into a bit of a One Last Breath by Creed hole. They're not a band I particularly like, but that song, it's not a song I particularly like either, but it's like one of those kind of things. It's like the giggle. It's kind of lodged in my brain. I did find a very nice acoustic bluegrass cover. It was one because I only recently I turned off history on YouTube because I was like I just want to see how long I can get away with doing this. I turned it back on, and one of my recommendations that they sent me was a 15-year-old video of these guys covering the One Last Breath bluegrass style, and it was really nice. So you know,
was that something you wanted, or was that yeah? So I guess
yeah.
That's a lesson you should learn. Destroy your history.
Yeah.
Forget your history.
Yeah. Well, don't forget your history, because if you forget your history, then you won't watch the moon landing video and be compelled to kill silence.
To commit homicide.
Yeah, on a regular basis.
You know me, I just got to get my yearly watch of the moon landing video. Man.
Do you think...
That is a good question. Do you think people, how many people today, like how many people this year have seen the moon landing?
Five.
No. It's not that low, but
somewhere between five and the entire population of this
okay.
planet.
I think a better question is how many people are watching it to debunk it in 2024, and how many people watching it to remember a point in history when we could do things.
A guy whose comfort character is Neil Armstrong, who just has to watch the moon every night.
Exactly.
It'd be funny to imagine that, like, the only people killing the silence right now are conspiracy theorists, because they're the ones who just keep watching the video and they keep killing the silence. Like,
yeah.
Well, yeah.
Regular people don't do it anymore. It's these wackos just, like, going out there.
I have a question on that. Do you think, like, when in universe, when like Ron Howard didn't make that one, but like in universe, whenever anyone makes like a movie about the moon landing, so like, you know, First Man or whatever, do they like subconsciously film the insert of an alien saying you should kill us all on sight, or do they like just leave it out? Do you think?
I think the insert of the alien killing us all on sight is now part of the footage. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. What we should be doing clearly is taking any movie that features the moon landing footage and inserting the shot of the silence into it, because it is now canon that the silence were in any movie that features the moon landing.
Deadline headline of like Tommy Lee Jones cast in First Man as alien saying you should kill us all on sight, you know, and Tommy Lee Jones gets his big. Well, he probably said I should kill you all on sight for even talking to me at this present moment in time. The Impossible Astronaut Day of the Moon. Let's just set the scene there. This is what we're talking about. The Series 6 double banked double header premiere with a very special returning friend. If they want to introduce themselves.
Oh, me. Yes, I'm Shelby / Shezza. I don't remember if I introduced myself as Shelby or Shezza last time, but whatever.
We were on a space bus. It didn't really matter, you know. There are more pressing issues, such as the bus breaking down. Impossible Astronaut Day at the Moon, dedicated to the memory of Elizabeth Sladen. I remember watching this for the first time vividly because so like I said before, when 11th Hour came out, we were traveling and we got to this like kind of there's like a hotel that has like self-service like apartments on the grounds. So we were going there, we missed like most of the episode. And we were going to the exact same place when this was going to air. And I was like freaking out because I was like, last time we were here late. We can get the start of it. I don't know what's going to happen. We got like, I would say 10 minutes before it was going to start. I vividly remember watching the last 10 minutes of Don't Scare the Hare, which I don't know if either of you know what Don't Scare the Hare is.
Zero clue.
I do not. I don't.
Oh, you two would love it. So basically, the BBC used to do this thing where, I mean, they still do it now. The lead-in show to whatever episode's going on is always kind of strange because for a while it was this show called Countryfile where, like, it's like, you know, this magazine show, but like, you know, let's go to see a farmer in West Devon who plants zucchinis and grows zucchinis, and then they'd be like, let's go see this like community garden group, and then they'd be like flogging otter the calendar sort of otters, excuse me. But for a while there was a a one season game show called Don't Scare the Hare where a giant robot rabbit that they built was in like a garden, and you could like sneak up to the hare or something to like steal its carrot or something. It was really, really strange. It only lasted one season because like everyone was like, this is terrible, this is not like an entertaining game show, like no one really seems to know what's going on, and also it's probably really expensive. But I remember watching the last like 10 minutes of that being like utterly perplexed, and then this comes on and I was like tonal whiplash. Like, you get like the dedication to this lane and everything afterwards as well. It's just like it's a really real kind of thing. But that was the 23rd and the 30th of April 2011, so you know, old news. This is the last time Toby Haynes directs. This is really because Toby Haynes has like a really weird run of like, he does Pandora Opens, Big Bang, Christmas Carol, this all in a row, and then just dips and never comes back.
He had enough.
Obviously he was on to do like, you know, Black Mirror and Andor, and he's doing the new Star Trek movie. So he's like spreading his net. And it's written by Stoyven Mouyvind. I can't really read that name, sorry. Never heard of him. But anyway, do you hear what this is in a sentence?
Yes, you go ahead. You first.
You go ahead. No, you go ahead. It's a new.
I was gonna say yeah. Stephen Moffat. I wasn't familiar with your game. I mean, I was, but I forgot that I was familiar with your game.
Exactly.
It's like I forgot. I respect your game a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's his game in a sentence. Doctor Who was shot by an astronaut, but it turns out to be an older version of himself who gets shot, and then they stumble onto a mysterious plot involving the long-awaited silence, mourn them later, Richard Nixon, and an orphan, which was also in Doctor Who, tricking the silence into getting humans to murder them on sight, and the orphan regenerating months later in New York City. So I don't know where we want to start, because
I actually have a question that is kind of tangentially related. So I love the X-Files. I'm very X-Files pilled.
Mm-hmm.
I thought if it were me, I would put Cigarette Smoking Man in a cameo in this. And then I was like, maybe they're not allowed to smoke on Doctor Who. So Has there ever been a character who's been smoking a cigarette on Doctor Who?
I can tell you off the top of my head, in the first ever story, William Hartnell lights up a pipe and smokes for like 2 seconds. And he's like, yes. And then I think his pipe goes out or something and he puts the pipe away. It's like the only time I know for certain someone smoked. I'm pretty sure someone has smoked. There's bound to be some cigarette depictions.
Yeah, should have like a Centauran, like just chain smoking in the back or something.
Big stogie going like, yeah.
There is the photo of the Cyberman on break taking smoking a cigarette. Yeah. By the way, according to the TARDIS wiki, known cigarette smokers include the Eighth Doctor, according to the book Half-Life, and Iris Wildtime. Mm. So that's something we know about her. But right away, really quick, sorry, this is a tangent. First of many, hi, welcome to the show. I opened the cigarette page in the TARDIS wiki, the Doctor Who wiki. The main image is from Thunderbirds. When I click it, it takes me to an episode of Thunderbirds.
Yeah, and I'm Daleks, still in. The Daleks are in Thunderbirds for like 2 seconds. I can't remember which episode it is.
So that's it. Okay, that's the one. That's it. That's why it's here. Yeah, it was a special note because of the licensed appearance by the Daleks. Mm. Wow.
You know what? I think the Daleks are hotboxing in those suits, so we can add them on there.
Davros has them smoking that good strain.
But, yeah, it just opens. Everybody gets a contact high immediately. Just
absolutely
the Yarvel strain. Well,
the crossover you wanted to see, Shelby. Instead, you got the crossover I think people in 2012 wanted to see, which is we have Mark Shepard, who is from Supernatural,
and the X-Files. Yeah.
Was he in the X-Files?
He's the Irish arsonist guy in like the first season.
Oh, you're right. Yes.
He's like, I love fire. His dad somehow, we'll talk about him more, but his dad is like, obviously in this for like 2 seconds, is a huge, like, you know, he's in like Wild at Heart, the David Lynch movie. He's in all this stuff. He's in Star Trek multiple times. Somehow never went on the X-Files. And also somehow, like, W. Morgan Shepherd around the X-Files, also somehow he was doing, because he's British, he was doing, like Z-Cars and all these, like, classic British TV shows. Never did Classic Who somehow before he went to America. So he's kind of, he's dodged both X-Files and Who until, you know, I guess only one of them at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really, like, them doing, like, a non-intentional, obviously, Supernatural crossover, but like having him come over onto this, and he's great in this, Mark Shepard, but them doing that, and also the episode obviously takes place in America, is shot in America, for the most part. I'm not sure.
Oh, I can tell you that Oval Office is not in America, but there's no chance.
And the orphanage is probably some like a house in Caerphilly or something. But it really feels like the big, like, you know, Beatlemania, Beatles 64, where we've made it in America. Let's go over there and give them what they want.
I was just gonna say, this is the season that I started watching Doctor Who. Like, I caught up, and I can't remember if I watched the first half, but I definitely watched the second half of season 6 live with friends in college. So yeah, like, this really feels like the zenith, the word I'm looking for? The peak. This is peak of the popularity and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this was also my first season watching live. And I remember there was like build up to this where they were like, oh, we shot in America. We shot 10 scenes in America, but they did. They shot in America and it looks good. It looks really good. They put all that money
in
those shots.
This is the thing. We talked about this before, Michelle, that like the last time Toby Haynes did a two-parter, obviously, is Pandorica Opens Big Bang. Pandorica Opens is like the most cinematic it's ever looked. It's incredible. Yeah. And Big Bang is just like, you know, oh, we gotta rush to get this done. So it's like kind of, it's like a step down. Here, both episodes just look like a reaction really to it, like, we're gonna like throw everything into this and make it look incredible. Like that one shot of the Viking funeral where like they're all lined up behind each other and like the sun is setting and like the fire is just kind of illuminating all of them is just an incredible shot. There's like so much
not only that, but also just the way the episode, I was honestly surprised, like it is maybe the most 90-minute story split into two episodes, which is made also, there's like one stumbling block, which is the beginning of the second part. But other than that, it's maybe the most cohesive, connective, just full steam ahead, two-parter. You could package this up as a movie, and this would work. I mean, it would still be low budget, but you could be like, this is the, you know, the special opening movie, you know, for the season. Like, you could do that. Like how cartoons used to do that, where they would be like, this is the special movie, and it's like an extra long episode. Moana you could 2. Do that with this. That's how it works. Well, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, well, actually, yeah, that's good. It is like it just feels like them going all out. I will say, like, in terms of my series 11 experience, this is maybe the most important season for me, because like this comes out during my big formative years. I make so many friends, not only like during the run of this series, but because of the series, like Peter, like we became friends through this season. I remember talking to like the own, like this, like the people I went to school with were never really into the show. And this season, it was like this season, season 4 and the snowmen in series 7 were the only times where people, it felt like people were actually like, you know, oh, let's watch this. Let's take part in this. Let's like really get into this.
Let's engage.
Yeah. And it didn't last long because like I had a friend who, like the only like proper friend in school I had who'd watch the show, didn't know it had come back. After like season, like didn't know series 6B had happened. Oh. And I was like, buddy. But yeah, it's like a really important season to me. And it's a season as well, it's important because they used to like, they don't do anymore. So they are just impenetrable now. But they used to like reshow this season specifically on like free view TV all the time between like, I'd say 2013 and like 2021, it was just on constantly. So it's like a season.
It's a very accessible season.
It is. Yeah. It's like that one kind of like, you know, obviously you have the kind of split point and obviously the arc kind of responds to, you know, what we did last time. But it's also like, I think it's by design accessible. Like, because like going back to think about like, you know, the American takeover, the American expansion, it feels like, you know, we're big now in this country. We have more eyes on us. Let's tell a story that, like, you know, people who watch the show will respond to, but people come onto the show will respond to as well in like a different way.
Yeah.
And I think it really works with that. I think it really works.
Oh, it absolutely works. Go ahead.
I will also say that there's nothing Americans love more than seeing themselves on TV.
Yeah.
Like, I personally hate when Big Finish puts them in America because I have to hear the worst accents I've ever heard before. Like,
yeah.
Foghorn Leghorn, it's atrocious. But like, and the other side note, it's like coming over to America and then still hiring Mark Shepard like a Brit is funny.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, generally, like it's like wow, and, like that's Utah.
And Stuart Milligan, right?
Stuart Milligan is I think, if he's not American, he's Canadian. The actors they have. So Stuart Milligan is North. He's from like North America, whether it's Canada or America, I don't know. You have like Chikwudi Ewuji, obviously, he's British.
Right. Yeah.
You have Kerry Shale. We'll get to Kerry Shale because Kerry Shale has a fascinating career as the doctor in the orphanage who is Canadian. You have the. This is a thing for me and Passive Future friend Sammy Crow. The guy who brings Amy to the bathroom, the special service agent, is British. I know this because the Action Man cartoon that aired, I think it was only really kind of big in the UK, but he played, there was like a live action segment where he played Action Man, and they filmed it outside of like Universal Studios Florida, where he'd stand around being like, kids, you should never get into a car with a stranger. I can do it because I'm Action Man, but you're not Action Man, so don't do it. And then it like came in front of like, you know, the Waterworld fucking stunt show, being like, you know, never take drugs from anyone, I'm Action Man. So I know he's British, but like other than that, like, you know, it is like a really strange thing to like go to America and just have all the actors be British or UK based. Yeah. I assume it's because when they went back to like the UK, they had to be like, okay, who can we rely on to like, you know, be available for
it's this like film? They had money, but even in the world of Doctor Who, they don't have that much money, which is why the finale of the two-parter takes place in a reused set, which they do try to justify, but
can we talk about
they didn't even need to.
Yeah. Do you think that was like planned, or do you think they're just like, we have this lying around still trying to use it?
Because they had it lying around.
It is like, we'll get into the silence because I think we're, I don't know, but like, obviously the last time we hear the silence is in Pandora Opens, and they have a different voice. And I will say, I have searched high and low. I cannot find out who voiced the silence in this. There is no credit on like TARDIS Wiki or IMDb for like voice of silence. And it's really, really confusing me. There's a guy on Cameo called Ross Mullen, who his whole thing is like, oh, I played the silence in Doctor Who, you know, like his book is like silence. But he only played like he's like one of the bodies, I think, because like,
right,
like a Dutch like dancer called like Marnix van der Broeke or something, who is like the main kind of silence actor. But like, you can't find out who played the silence. It is a really weird thing where like they feel kind of like they're kind of playing it by ear in terms of the depiction, because like you hear like, we get all these like references like up to this point being like, you know, the silence, like, you know, like you get the flashback thing of like being like, can you hear that, Rory? No, it's silence. Silence came in, silence, silence, silence. Yeah. And then it's like these guys in like very like wet like tailored suits, like their suits are like drenched in water, and like they're the big kind of gray alien depiction, really effective design, but it does kind of feel a little confused, I will say,
except,
as well.
Except for when they move.
When they
except
move,
for when yeah. they move is when it gets me. Is when I go, nope, that's a guy in a suit.
The thing as well is that Radio Times, I'll never forgive Radio Times. Radio Times kind of spoiled that they were the silence. And I remember that happening and being like, guys, like, I don't think it was like meant to be like a kind of a hidden reveal. Like, I think you're meant to know like these guys are like the silence. But I remember reading that on Radio Times, like the season six preview, being like, and who are these mysterious silence? These aliens in suits. And I was like kind of, 14 Romy was kind of crushed, because I was like, you know, I'm really looking forward to seeing who these guys are. I think it's much more of like an effective surprise when it turns out like, oh, these guys are, you know, are the kind of people who were pulling the strings last year. Even though I do think it obviously gets like resolved in terms of like, you find out who they are and stuff, but like, it is kind of a strange way of introducing them like as a physical force, I think, but I don't know.
It's hard to talk about. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
I also think it's such a Stephen Moffat plotline. It's like, you know, you thought we as humans were doing all those impressive things. No. It was the silence. I guess it's kind of unclear. Like, are they the only reason we made it to space, or are they just like the idea?
They made us want to go to space because they needed space.
So we did it ourselves.
Yeah. But they were like, we need you to do this. So, because we need a suit for this child. So, you know.
Okay. That makes me feel a little better. I was like, wow, that's like one of our only crowning achievements as a species. We can't have that taken away from us.
Well, then we did another crowning achievement, which is we genocided the silence.
Really skimmed over that hole.
Yeah. The thing that gets me about that is that I'm always like, hold on a second. Like, okay. It's What are the Silence doing? They never actually say what the Silence are doing. And so the Doctor being like, and now I'm going to kill all of you.
What they're doing, what I can piece together from what we get is that this is literally all the same, like, you know, shaping human history and stuff is really all just a means to an end to kill the Doctor.
No. I don't think you can make that connection fully from this episode.
You can't from this episode, but I think with like future context, it comes into view. Like,
But that's what I'm saying. Like within the context of this episode, you don't know what the Silence are doing. You don't know what they were doing up until then. So when the Doctor is like, "Now you all going to die," it's like, "Listen, these guys did kill that random woman for no reason." Still, again, they did not explain why they killed that random woman. But at the same time, what have they like done? Like, why? What have they done that? To deserve this fate, like they've been manipulating us, but for what? And we know what it is, but
yeah,
we the audience watching this episode don't. So when that happened, I was like, "Whoa!"
It is like I love these two episodes. I think they're great. The Silent stuff just feels like what we've kind of touched on, like, you know, myth arc apathy and stuff before, but like I think a huge part of, like, you know, the general consensus of like this season being confusing, this season being kind of like, you know, a bit of a mess comes from the fact that the Silence just feel like they're laying the tracks as they're coming along, rather than like, you know, we have an idea of like this Silence going to do this and this, like the conclusion, it feels so jammy to be like, you know, Canton tricks them to saying you should kill us all on sight on camera, even though like
he's literally holding a camera right there, like why he should
like slide phone.
and at no point the Silence, the super smart race who clearly is more advanced than humans, go, "You are clearly recording me with a video camera." Like, you were making no attempt to like that plot. That is a stumbling block. I think the entire moment when they're like explaining the Silence and how to track the Silence in those first 10 minutes of the second episode is so like bogged down.
Yeah.
And it contributes to what you're explaining, because I think there's something genius this two part of this, which is in the first episode, we are on the side of the Silence in that we see the Silence and we remember them. And so that entire episode is great because you're always like, every scene, you're like, you know that there's a bomb on the table, and the characters don't. And the characters literally can't. So you're like, how are they going to realize there's a bomb under the table? And in the second episode, it's like, we got you here, fam. Here's how they're going to do it. There's two different ways they can do it. They introduce them back to back. So it's the marking of the hands and then the recorder in the hand. So it's two ways to track them, and they're explaining how they work. And in that scene where they're inside the TARDIS explaining everything, they get away with it. They just barely get away with it because it's such a clunky scene. But it ends with that moment of him adjusting the bow tie and everyone being like, look at him weird, and then he sees that, and then Mark Canton sees that there's something in his hand, and he sees the recording, and they still explain it, but just that scene, that moment, completely shifts the episode into horror. So we went from a mystery to a horror, and it works so well. But once that horror is done, you're left with, like, again, what is the Silence? Like, the Silence, what we know about the Silence is that the Silence is not so much a species as they are a church who is doing something. So the Silence is a group. Yeah. But then this specific alien is also called the Silence.
It does feel like they're throwing everything at the wall and just like, there you go, they're priests. Great job, guys, and moving along. Like,
the design is clashing so much with what they do end up doing in the story, because the design is such a good design. And I really do think that if they'd never showed the Silence walking, they would be one of the scariest villains, because the moment they start walking and the scene where they are in the ceiling, even though it is a funny bit to have all these guys in suits in the ceiling, I think those are the two scenes that make them feel the most like guys in suits. Mm-hmm. But everything apart from that, their design, the way they talk, the way they communicate, the way they work is such a good monster idea. And it speaks to the story. They are gray aliens, so they look like aliens used to look in the imagination for people in the 60s. They're wearing suits like government men. Makes sense, again, 60s, 70s, we're going into that paranoia conspiracy thing, Nixon administration, all that makes sense. They work with editing memories. Again, makes sense, we're talking about the Nixon administration. Tapes, this is a guy all about tapes. Like,
yeah, and like then, but, MK Ultra as well, like that's around that period as well.
Everything about them feels like it was perfectly made for an episode set in the 1969 talking about the space race. But their ultimate end goal is not that. And so I think that's a lot where the confusion comes from. It's like if the Weeping Angels, if you had Blink, and then at the end of season 3, there was an episode where, like, actually the Weeping Angels, I almost described the Vision, but it is, it's as if there was a scene where they're like, and actually the Weeping Angels are part of a Weeping Angel organization where they do things that Weeping Angels do, but not the things you saw them do in Blink. They do other stuff too. But they still call them, you know, it's so confusing. That's kind of where the confusion comes from for me.
I also think these two-parters do a better job of setting up the other mystery of the season, like, that we get to. And I think it sets that up a lot better. Like, I think that part that I remembered what this connected to later, I was, like, moved more by that than, like, the Dr. Silence nonsense, which I just remember like the ending of, and I was just like groaning, like preemptively groaning about the question that cannot be asked or whatever that's I was like, oh god. This.
I will say, like, the whole thing with, you know, the Lake Silencio, one thing is that Matt Smith plays the older doctor really well. Like, the way he's like, you know, this guy who's like clearly knows what's going to happen, he's going to still be drawn. But I think it's a really interesting way that, like, and it's very Moffat that, like, they frame the whole, like, Doctor dying mystery as, like, rather than being like, you know, how did the Doctor die and then invite us all here? It's more like they frame it as, like, what would happen if your best friend or, like your, like, significant other or something got shot before your eyes and died, and then you, like, you categorically, like, said farewell, you buried them, whatever, and then 5 minutes later they walked out, like, joking with you and being like, hey, how's it going, guys? And how, like, how your life would go if, like, you knew this was gonna happen, and also held on to, like, maybe the resentment. Like, the stuff with River I think is so interesting, where she's like, you know, I saw him die, but I know that, like, any minute now, there'll be a moment where he will, like, technically speaking, like, I'll see him die again because he won't know who I am. And I'm terrified at that moment. And then you get that last moment where, like, where she realizes, oh, you haven't experienced, like, a kiss before me, but I've experienced it so many times with you. And you get that moment where she's like, she just knows that, like, it's the king of the end for, like, for them. I think it's just such an interesting, like, runner in conjunction with, like, what we find out in a couple episodes time, like, who River is, and, you know, they've obviously the finale being, like, their wedding. I think it's just an interesting way of framing that whole mystery. But on the flip side, and Shelby, you and I were talking about this earlier on, it is kind of getting tiring how often they go back to the Amy and Rory are fighting well. And Amy and Rory don't know who they are, and if they're quarreling, and does Amy actually like Rory? You know, all this stuff. Because it happens again next season.
She's always so mean to him. It's like, it's so, I can't fathom it at all. Like, you know, I don't hate people that love Amy. I don't like her at all, but more power to you. But she's so poorly written. Like, I am just always so flummoxed because I think Moffat, like, writing women is such a weak point for him. But, like, River is such a good character. And then you have Amy. It's like, oh, Lord.
I, too, like to refer to my loved ones in vague terms.
You, like, think it's the other guy, but it's really you. It's like, oh, my God. Yeah.
I can't wait when I'm married and I'm like thinking about my partner and I'm like, oh, you stupid face,
you term that shit. I can
use. Yeah, you term I can use that can refer to anyone like, yeah, it is a bit of a contrived. But here's the thing. Until you said that, I was actually on the side of liking that plot line because I thought it was setting up their divorce in series seven. So I was like, oh my God, Moffat, I was wrong. Oh, you did set it up. Oh, you were actually.
Technically, it is though, because like, yeah. she explains that like whatever happens here, like they stop her from having kids after she has I was gonna say spoilers, but if you like, no one is doing this for the first time, and especially not with us. But like, it's obviously she has like it's setting up like, you know, both her with like, you know, Melody and the whole story there. I do just think like, knowing what we know as well, like with the flesh stuff that comes down the road, but like I think as well with. Like that final regeneration thing, it's a lot of not so much plate spinning, but it's a lot of like toppings on the nachos, so to speak.
They're just
adding so much, so much, and some of it pays off. Some of like it kind of all pays off in a certain way. Some of it doesn't really pay off as much as other ways. But I think it's just like it's epic on a scale that they never really go back to, in a sense. Because like
on a scale they cannot match.
Yeah,
to the point that they try to match it in the bat. The first, literally, this season ends with him being like, "I've gone too big," and then the next season, like, "Yeah, we're gonna go big again," and it doesn't work.
And then, it's such a 2010s like puzzle box approach to storytelling. Like it really feels so much of its time. I watched this and I really was like, obviously this aired in the States like on BBC America, but I was like, this is such what the this podcast I like, Exahard Great, calls like blue sky television, like TNT, like TBS, like that kind of like white collar suits, like that genre of like good TV, but not great TV. And like this, that was like the peak time for that. And this really hit. I was like, this is so 2010s. I really enjoyed it, honestly.
It's that I know exactly what that blue sky stage is, when you are in the hands of a crew of people who have been making television for more than 10 years. And so even if the plot lines they deliver are not 100% great, they are going to deliver them with, like, you know, poise and grace and the kind of efficiency of storytelling that can only come if you've been writing for years. If you've been working with a crew that works on television for years. You know, it's like plot lines wrap up, beats connect. There's jokes here that are just little jokes and they don't go anywhere and they work so well. I love that they bring Nixon back and have him come out of the prison. It's like, and you know, because they've done a good job as TV writers, you get the joke. When he comes out of the box, you're like, how's he going to get out of this? Then Nixon comes out and you go, oh, they made him do it again. It's that kind of like great characters welcome writing that no longer exists because everybody forgot how to do television in the last 5 years.
Speaking of Nixon.
Yeah.
Oh,
Eleven
yes.
is responsible for Watergate inadvertently, right?
Yeah, Eleven is responsible for Nixon becoming Nixon in this. Oh, my God. First of all, I want to mention this quote from Moffat, which there's two reasons I want to mention it. He says that when he started writing the episode, he had to look up who the president was at the time. And he said,
honestly, saying,
that's a bit rubbish. He almost thought he almost considered making a generic unnamed president. And then he was like, but this is a real event, so it would be fun to use Nixon. Here's the thing. When I first watched this, it was 2012. I was 16. There's no excuse for this. I thought Kennedy was president during the moon landing because he's the guy that always gets brought up when people talk about the moon. Mm-hmm. So when they showed Nixon, I remember being like, how did these guys making a time travel show get history wrong? And then I Googled it. I was like, wait, he was president during the moon landing? Like, what? It's just, it makes no sense. I don't track it. I know it's history, but it's like Nixon as a creature cannot exist outside of the 1970s. So when you tell me he was president in 1969, I'm like, no, he wasn't. You're lying. You're making this up.
I will say, yeah.
This circles back to the fact that JFK was killed like the day before the original Doctor Who aired.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, Doctor Who has never.
you were like, no one got shot before Doctor Who aired. What are you talking about?
you know, Twin Peaks, The Return, Episode 8, where David Lynch is like, the biggest evil in the world, it was created by the nuclear explosion. I mean, you can make an argument that the moment JFK was shot, Doctor Who was born. It's like the universe balancing itself out.
Exactly. JFK never had to watch an episode of Doctor Who.
What is this, the Jumblies?
Oh my god, he was the last person to exist in the world without Doctor Who. JFK was the last person to exist in the world without the TV show Doctor Who. I cannot believe that. I need to stop talking.
Lee Harvey Oswald saw a tortured miracle day and was like, I cannot abide this anymore. I'm sorry.
Oh my god, that is insane.
I will say, Nixon, I do not remember him being. I remember him being a lot more present than he is. He's in like maybe three or four or five scenes. There is one. This is a hard thing for me to explain without sounding like a crazy person. It's neither here nor there. In the scene with the two NASA guys, where he comes out of the turret, it's like, you can let him go. The two NASA guys look like if you cast Jason Sudeikis and John.
I wrote that too.
wait, because I'm about to go a bit strange. If you cast them both in a sort of like Saturday night style movie of the making of something, but only if they're at their current and younger ages respectively, so like older Sudeikis and younger Lithgow in like because they had that weird vibe of like, for a second I was like, is that Jason? Well, I wasn't like, is that Jason Sudeikis? Because obviously he's not going to do fucking Doctor Who in 2011. But like, it was like a whole thing of like. They had that weird vibe, but Nixon, we talked about like how, you know, they go to America and they bring all these like British actors over them and stuff. This is what happens when you port over the Churchill depiction to this kind of framework where Shelby and I were joking before, where's Kissinger? Like, Kissinger should be like perched on his shoulder being like, you know, Doctor Who should kill all these people and then I will be alive for the rest of time until I die in like a random day in like 2022 or whatever. But like, where is Kissinger? Where is like, you know, where is like the iconography of Nixon is obviously like, you know, like evil, but like there's this none of it here. And like, I think if like that whole thing you said about like him having to look up like who was president and okay, I guess I'll use Nixon. If you had him be like a bit more dedicated to like, you know, using Nixon, I think you get way more out of like this idea of this like inherently like evil guy having to like contend with, you know, everything going on. The Doctor has to contend with this like thoroughly kind of disagreeable guy. But it just becomes like, you know, this befuddled kind of guy who just kind of doesn't really know what to do. And it's just like, I don't know.
There's literally one specific Nixon bit, which is him being like, trust nobody and tape everything.
Mm.
That's the only like Nixon. Well, and at the end where like, they're never going to forget you. But also like, the truth of the matter is that if this is also the very 2011 thing. If Stephen Moffat were to actually write this and like, let's actually use Nixon, he would not want to do it because I think Nixon, the instant the TARDIS goes away, he says, bomb England. Like, He would not. It, when he comes out and he's like, you two are protecting the displacement, or you're so great, and I'm Nixon. I'm like, no, he was the most awkward, like, Weasley guy ever. He would not go, yes.
He wouldn't have taken that call.
He would have been like, shut the fuck up, little girl, stop calling me. He would not care. He would be like, yeah, Henry, there's this girl calling me, bomb Florida, until she stops calling me.
Okay,
like,
Richard.
It's just at the end, like the little final bit where he's like, you know, I'm very liberal and I think you can marry. First of all, it is a great understated Nixon bit that he immediately guesses that Kenton wants to marry a black person. That is the first thing he guesses. No hesitation, not even any question. Is anybody like black? Like, he knows. We know who Nixon wants.
Also, but Nixon didn't say black. Like, he obviously couldn't say a slur, but in his heart, he said a slur.
Literally, that face he's making at the end, right, when they go, "What?" It's like, in his head, he is thinking the F slur. He is like, yes. They cut because he was about to say it in real life. Like, that's also the Churchill thing, you know? These people were not good, and I think with Nixon specifically, we have audio evidence of his not goodness. So, so it's like it feels a little bit hollow, and it also feels like the something you could only do in 2011, because it's just not worth the hassle, and it's not even that you can't do this today. Not because people would complain; it's just because we know better. It's like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have River Song be like some good stuff too, and it's like, yeah, he did make the EPA. Like, I'm not gonna be
against his will. Like,
yeah, he did pass the Clean Water Act. He also was caught on tape being like talking about how the Jew in America will never do this or that. Like, he was not like, and so it's like, I feel like this is the and to me, that's why I'm like. Whenever people bring up Chibnall and they say, oh, in the Chibnall era, we got all these, like, you know, very centrist. You got Kurt Bland, which is an episode about Amazon that says, actually, there are heroes on both sides. But the thing is, Doctor Who has always had this problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever step out of the context of a working class English, white English person, Doctor Who will always have this problem. It will have this problem in Rosa. It will have this problem with, like, Mel making that, Donna making that, you come in different colors when Shuchi comes out. Like, you will always have this problem because it wants to be a fun, yay, cool show about time travel. And it also wants to be like, let's go to the space launch and meet the president, the moon launch and meet the president. Mm-hmm. Oh, the president was Nixon. Oh, no. And I feel like Doctor Who needs to... Dot and Bubble, I don't know if you saw Dot and Bubble, Shelby, but Dot and Bubble feels like the closest Doctor Who has ever come to trying to negotiate that, you know? Try to be like, how much can we have our cake and have our cake and eat it too? How much can we acknowledge the world while also getting to have fun? And I feel like that's the closest they're ever going to get until the people running the show are still white. Mm-hmm. No offense to Russell T. Davis, but like until the people writing the stories are not, and I will even say, you know, until they're also not English, you're going to get this problem. But then the question is like, do you want Doctor Who to be an English show? I kind of want it to be an English show. To be honest, I would not want to have, as a non-American, I think non-Americans writing Doctor Who can always has a little bit of like a problem because there's something inherently British about how stupid the show can be with things like Nixon. And I think there is a world where it doesn't head into these problems. But I also think that's the same world where we don't get what I think is an admittedly funny moment where Nixon comes out of a fucking box and says, hey, everybody, it's me, President Nixon. You know, like,
exactly.
I just came out of the TARDIS. Like, you know, I should be able to have my cake and eat it too, you know?
I think as well, the thing is that as long as a show is going to have this character fly around in a box that says police, you're not going to get like, you know, it's a very like neoliberal show, I think, at its heart. Mm. And it's never going to be, you know, it's never going to be the kind of show like someone like Malcolm Hulk would have wanted to be, where it's, you know, very much kind of not that. Something, this is going way off.
Oh, can I say something real quick?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, just kind of related. Have either of y'all seen like the original Quantum Leap? Because like, I feel like
a little
like that version, it's like, it's good, but it's also such a slog trying to like navigate
the
cultural progress of America. And it's like a really good show, but yeah, like I feel like you could accidentally make Doctor Who too much. Like that Rosa feels like a Quantum Leap episode to me. And so like, yeah, I agree. I think like it needs to be fun, but obviously like, y'all are just going to throw Nixon in here and not even have the Doctor side-eye him, like, once?
yeah, no, like, no, just, there's nothing, And again, that's the thing, like, Henry Kissinger, like, we don't expect Harry Kissinger to come in, you know? But I also don't expect River Song to say some good stuff, too. Really, guys, come on!
Yeah, but, kind of going a complete 180, one scene in this that I think really stands out, and we kind of touched on that, is the orphanage scene. The whole thing with Kerry Shale's character, Kerry Shale, this is, there's a very strange link between this episode and Chris Pratt. I don't know if either of you know what it is.
What is the link?
Kerry Shale, who plays the orphanage doctor who's lost his mind because he's been... I think the implication is that he's seen and forgotten the silence so many times he's just lost his mind. Because, like, he's just kind of... He's like, I'm alone, I'm all alone kind of stuff. He voiced Star-Lord in LEGO Marvel Super Heroes 2, the video game, which is a really strange match of energies. He also wrote the 2003 PS2 video game Dog's Life, which is about a dog that goes on an adventure. Very strange guy. He's got a lot of like, really, really weird credits. He's also in stuff like Yentl and, you know, that's another link to Barbra Streisand. But and the I'm whole sorry, scene...
let's not move on really. Just one moment. Yeah. You're telling me there was a PS2 game called A Dog Story?
Dog's Life.
A Dog's Life.
Where it adds like a pedigree chum like promotional thing where like you collect pedigree chum and stuff. It's like the first game I have for PS2 that I played, and it's like a dedicated like shitting button as well where you shit. It's a really weird game. But
we used to just make video games of anything.
Yeah, we really did.
That's what I'm like. They really just used to. Oh my god, it was made by Frontier.
Yeah.
Frontier is British? Honestly, that explains a lot about Planet Coaster. That I'm thinking about it. Them being British explains a lot about Planet Coaster. Mm-hmm. And Roller Coaster Tycoon. Okay, all right. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Kerry Shale, very interesting guy. He also hosts Bob Dylan podcast, apparently. So, you know, good for him. He's in Labyrinth as well, and stuff like that.
Wow, what a good year.
Yeah, he's in a lot of stuff, but like the whole like you know production design, the big bloody letters, it's like proper Moffat like dark comedy of like you know this one guy has lost his mind and just doesn't really know what's going on. Canton shoots the guy. He's like, oh, I think someone's been shot. You better come have a look see. Really great kind of moment. It is just like. I don't know, there's just some, like, I think it's two great episodes that look incredible, that move incredibly well, that have so much great, like, kind of, you know, character writing, so much great kind of atmospheric stuff. But, like, one, this is nitpicking, and we don't like nitpicking, but, like, the fact the end of this episode is just the Doctor shooting sonic screwdriver stuff at aliens and River shooting aliens.
Yes.
And then they escape. Yeah. It just feels like a real kind of like, we got 5 minutes, let's wrap this up. And
Yeah.
The slow-mo also is like...
The slow-mo, the cliffhanger as well, where she's like, what are you doing?
Oh my god. That cracked me up so bad. I was like, what are y'all doing?
And the result, and they don't solve that cliffhanger. Like they cut back to it. It's like she shoots her, and the like we just don't see that the bullet did hit the thing until like halfway through.
I thought I missed something because I was like not 100% paying attention. And then I was like, wait, like, are we not going to address that she's not at a child?
If you want to talk about missing something, let's talk about the fact that why are they being hunted down at the start of part two?
I think it's just, it's like the whole thing with the silence shaping human history together, especially the Ingus's Canton and the Doctor's plan to get them all together is to have it look like they've been hunted down. Because the Doctor is obviously in like this impenetrable prison that he wants to hide like the TARDIS and stuff. So I think it's just a really kind of convoluted way of them being like, you know, we'll sneak you all into this by having you pretend to be shot. It is kind of like, it feels like an image over plot kind of decision to have, like, you know, this, like,
it does,
we're gonna go to like the Hoover Dam and, you know, the desert, mm-hmm. and have all these great things like a skyscraper in New York. River Song always going back to New York because she's in New York again next season as well. But like, it is just kind of, I think it is just them being like, we need some kind of big set piece to open this up. Let's just have like these guys get shot by Canton. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff in this that I'm like, I don't know, like Rory's into Laurel and Hardy. He's explained all the jokes. I don't even think he needs to explain the jokes of Laurel and Hardy because like it's fairly straightforward. It's fat man funny, quiet man funny. They do funny things. There's just like, there is just, I think the silence kind of just kind of is a bit of an issue for them. And I don't think they've ever really known how to handle the silence because like,
they haven't come up with a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
The only time I've ever heard an idea for the silent that made me go, oh, okay, that's interesting, is that audio where there's like a confession silent.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But yeah, that's because they're kind of a single-use monster. Like, mm-hmm. there's Doctor Who monsters that are... The Weeping Angels are a single-use monster because...
Yeah.
You cannot they're use them
very
for...
Very conceptual.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing else you can... You can't have a Dalek story. Like, as in the Series 1 episode Dalek with the Silence or the Weeping Angels because that's not what they're made for. And so... But these, the thing is that most of the time, whenever we have these one single use monsters, they come and go. But the silence are the only ones where they just keep coming back. And at no point I'm ever like, oh, okay, I get why this had to be the silence.
It's, you know, so strange that like they're in Revolution of the Daleks in the prison because like one who's arresting the silent, like you just turn your back, you're forgetting you're arresting the silent.
Exactly.
It's like mm. yeah, but like, I mean, obviously they're in the finale, they're in Time of the Doctor. That's when we get the explanation that they're confessional priests that got drafted into this sect that decided to kill the Doctor, and then they're in all these audio stuff, and it's like, I remember the big buzz about Series 6 was like, we're not going to bring any monsters back. It's going to be all new monsters. Not to be confused with all real monsters or whatever. Real monsters.
All new monsters. Mm,
but like, the problem with doing that is that like, it feels like, well, one, that wasn't true because Cybermen are in the penultimate episode. But two, it feels like... Like the iconography is so powerful, but there's nothing really supporting the iconography.
The story isn't, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they rely on the iconography like going forward, and that's fine. Like Big Finish rely on iconography is like Big Finish's business plan. It's like we rely on like you looking at a cover and seeing like a dream crab and, you know, the Mox of Balhoon. I mean, like, I'm gonna buy that because Colin Baker says Mox of Balhoon. But like, there's not much substance, I think. And it's unfortunate because they look incredible. They are imposing. They have this great kind of atmosphere, but they're kind of running very quickly.
I also think the thing you just said about iconography over story. I'm kind of... they haven't shown up yet. We're still a couple of episodes away. I also think that's why a certain group of characters introduced in this season, which were clearly earmarked for a spinoff, yet never took off. I think that's why that certain group has not taken off to this day, despite the fact that they will go on to have multiple appearances in the next few seasons, to the point that they might as well be like the supporting cast of this, of the Moffat era. But never have I ever heard anyone say, organically say, I want to see a Paternoster Gang spinoff, because they are icons. It's there's a woman, there's a Silurian, and there's a Centauran. That's how they're introduced. That's they literally are icons meant to exist as like single use things. And then for you to be like, don't you want to hear their story? It's like, no, not really. There's nothing interesting about them.
And also, their Big Finish stuff isn't really interesting. From what I heard, it's not that great.
Yeah, I've already seen what the joke is. I've already seen her be like, I'm a lesbian lizard. So yeah. To see her doing that in the 17 other Big Finish boxes, I'm not that interested. You know, that's not what I want
to
see.
Yeah, but instead of Colin Baker showing up to be like, lesbian lizard, oh dear. Or Paul McGann.
It's really, that's another 2011 thing where it's like, we got to make sure people know we're gay, but we will never kiss.
I had the same thing of like, my gay black husband. I was like, that's such a Moffat line. Like, okay. We get it, Moffat.
But you get it. You are an ally. Congratulations, my guy.
Although he followed Graham Linehan on Twitter last time I looked, so.
It means nothing.
I know it means nothing, but like,
Twitter, you know, I need us all to understand now that we are heading into 2025, I think humanity needs to understand that Twitter was just humanity had like a blip of insanity called Twitter, and we need to leave it behind. Forget it. It's over.
A social experiment by standard. Yeah.
The social experiment that was Twitter has ended. We no longer need that stuff. Like that's I'm calling my shot here. There's not going to be a new, people are talking about like, what's going to be the next Twitter, the next social media everyone has. There's not going to be that. There's not going to be another big social media, you stupid slut. It's over. There's only going to be smaller and smaller niche social medias. And then it's just going to be YouTube. And that's it.
A time traveler goes back in time and steps on a butterfly. And we get an Elon Musk historical. That's exactly like how Nixon's treating in this.
We don't need to pretend. That's the fucking Star Trek Discovery had. Little like, Elon Musk was a great, like, fucking, if the person isn't dead, don't put them on your TV show. Guys, listen to me. Science fiction writers, hello, listen to me. You are about to write a story set in the future and you want to give a shout out to someone in the present. That's great. If it's not a song or a book or a TV show, or if it's a living person, wait until they're dead. Trust me on this one. Wait until they're dead. Because Twitter may be gone, but screenshots are forever. That's it. They will always have receipts.
We also do have one of my least favorite sci-fi tropes. It's like pregnancy trauma. This is the introduction of that. And that's why I once described Stephen Moffat as going to the Chris Carter Myth Arc School of Writing. Because, they're both redheads and they both give them pregnancy trauma. And it's like, okay, I get it. I see what you're trying to say here, dude.
It's funny that you said science fiction, because it is like, for a while there, if you were a science fiction or a fantasy show and you had a female character and you wanted to make them deeper, you just gave them pregnancy trauma.
Yeah.
That was like all they did. Damn.
I have this like whole idea, which I won't get into because it's like kind of, but like we had Mary Tyler Moore very defiantly be like, I don't need a kid. And I don't think we've gone back to that. I think every other, like, and obviously a lot of it's informed by their own personal lives. Like Tina Fey writing in like Liz Lemon's pregnancy plotline wanting a kid was because she had kids. Like it was something that she wanted. So I'm not going to like, you know, discount her lived experience, but we don't really have any like we don't really have that many women on TV who don't express wanting to have a kid at all, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have even less.
Yep.
I always think about this tweet that it wasn't even this year. It was a tweet last year where somebody was like, does anyone notice how for a while there it was okay to be gay and now it's on television and movies and now it just isn't? Like, if there's a gay kiss, there's a controversy. And for a short while there, it was okay and it no longer is. And I think it was that with, like, women not having plot lines related to having kids.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. We do need to bring that back. Sorry, everyone. Sorry to end the Nixon episode and the downer.
I can bring it back up. I can bring it back up. I forgot to mention something, which is the last.
Oh, I also have something I want to mention that we'll bring it back up, but well, you go first.
Mine is less interesting. Mine is that Dr. Renfrew, Carrie Shale, the orphanage guy. I don't have to say this without sounding insane, but he moves and talks like an L.A. Noire character, but like the original release, not the re-release. Like, he has a human PS3 jank to him in a way that I find very endearing.
I see what you mean. Yeah, I get what you mean. Yeah, I see it. I see your vision.
Thank you.
My last thing, Shelby, you first.
My last thing is that we did not even talk about how horny Eleven and River are, like, at all. Really, other than the kiss, but they're very horny, and I was not here for it when I first watched it, but now I'm very much here for it. I really support it. I think it's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Because now, oh my god, we were the ones being like, this isn't a necessary sex scene.
makers when
we were kids. Yeah, but now we are, you know, that is a good, yeah, that's true. I do like it when it is a very much a lot of, like, I know what sex is. I think I will make this comparison in a future episode, but it is a lot of, like, I know what sex is, guys. So don't worry about it. Here it is.
That Dirty Rock episode where Liz is like, I think she's like taking her birth control or something. And Suri is like, I think you're supposed to take that every day. And she's like, I've been sexually active since I'm 25. I think I know what I'm doing. Like, you know, Levin has a little bit of a Liz vibe now that I'm thinking about it. Like, a little awkward.
That's a good point. Yeah. My last thing, and this is a really, I hope it's a good one. My last thing is, do you think the Doctor Who crew high-fived each other when they found public domain footage of the NASA guys blinking erratically? Because when they cut to that, I could tell somebody was like, oh my god, there's footage of them doing the thing we're doing in the future.
Saved myself $300 or $3,000, yeah, or how much it would cost to do that CGI.
To hire Clint Howard to just sit that is his name, right? The guy who's always in these NASA roles, Clint Howard. He's always the bald guy with the headset.
Yeah, because he's Ron Howard's brother. So they were like, Clint trying to play this guy. He's like, yeah, sure. I'll do
it. So wait, he's only done that once?
I think he does it in, he's like a radar guy in one of the Austin Powers as well, I think is what you're thinking of. He's like,
oh yeah, he's in, yeah. And in Night of the Museum, he's literally there as a NASA guy. We need to bring back those guys. The NASA guys, white shirt, black tie, headset,
yeah,
glasses.
And like, button up, but it's like short sleeves. So it just like looks very nerdy. Also, Houston, first word spoken on the moon, let's go. Yep. I'm a proud Houstonian, so I got to shout out my people.
It is great. I mean, it's funny that we talked so much about the Doctor episode about the moon landing, but we never talked about the moon landing. The moon landing is great. I love the moon landing. Every time I see the moon landing, I'm like, damn, that's cool. We went to the moon.
They also
the guy in the moon.
We'll come back to the moon landing in part because adventure in space and time, or time and space, introduces Verity Lambert by having her watch the moon land with Jacqueline Hill, who played Barbara, but it's played by someone else.
Is that the scene where Verity Lambert says, and then one day we can have the silence in there?
Yeah, and then, and then, like, what are you talking about? And then
what are you talking about?
Ian Chesterton shows up again, like, hello. But yeah, I don't know. Do I have anything else? I think I do. The tally marks were like briefly, and like, you know, when like the big internet craze was mustaches, and like you'd have mustache.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The tally marks for the Doctor Who version for a while. I remember that being like the huge thing. Like everyone was posting like their tally mark photos with like that really like crusty old Instagram filter.
The tally marks to me are like, you know, that heartbreaking, the worst person you know just made a great point. Mm-hmm. Heartbreaking, the worst writer you know just had a great idea. That's what the tally marks are, where I'm like, oh, fuck, that's a really good idea. Because it's such a simple little makeup thing. And every time in that scene with Amy, when they cut, and each cut, she has more and more all over her. It's such a good, like, and you know exactly what that means. You know, the instant they cut, and they have that, and they play that sting, you're like, oh, they're fucked. They're absolutely fucked.
But yeah, I don't know. We didn't mention the Kovarian cameo, but like, I think we'll get to Kovarian in a couple of weeks, because it's not really much of interest now, beyond her, you know, kind of popping up and being like, I think she's just dreaming.
It took me back. Remember what it was like to watch television and be like, what was that? I wonder what will happen next.
We have something to post about on the forums.
Yes. We can post about this on the forums, and it's fun, and it's not a hassle, and it's not a chore. And I don't have to pretend I'm a producer and fan cast and imagine who could be these characters.
The other thing as well is that there was that kind of semi-viral clip from the Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 press where Karen Gillan realized Chukwudi Awuji was in this episode, because she didn't know that before.
Yeah. And they share the scene together.
They talk to each other on camera, and she was like, oh, that was you. Okay. I don't know.
I mean, again, if you go to the UK, chances are you are standing next to someone who's been in a Doctor Who episode. So,
Yeah.
If you ever ask the question, have you ever been acted with someone who's in a Doctor Who episode? Just say yes, because chances are. The answer is yes, and I will correct you.
I mean, you already have.
I'll tell the story now. We were recording another episode, and this news came out that
Watchdogs.
Russell Tovey is doing some Watchdog thing. And in the article, Eurogamer was like, oh, and Russell Tovey, as you know, is in the Doctor Who spinoff that's coming up, because we were talking about the spinoff. And then, oh, here's all the other people in this that were also in Doctor Who. And then they were like, oh, David Morrissey, Freema Jemian, blah, blah, blah. And then they were like, also in the cast are Tina Melier and Gary Beadle. I don't believe either of them have been in Doctor Who. And immediately I was like, I know for a fact they were. Tina Melier was the general, and Gary Beadle was in Sarah Jane Adventures. So I went to the comments and I almost wrote Tina Melier was in the general, but somebody had already corrected them on that. So I just wrote, Gary Beadle was in Sarah Jane Adventures, so you're wrong. I didn't say you're wrong, but I did feel very happy implied. Correcting him. Yeah. Don't mess with us, Doctor Who fans. We remember everything you were on.
I legitimately have one last thing.
Go ahead.
I went to a Ren Faire in Texas, probably around when this aired. And there was like a fire pit where they had some belly dancers, because it was kind of cold. It was like in March. And there was somebody dressed up as the 11th Doctor with the Stetson. So I kept just texting my friend, like, I saw the 11th Doctor at the belly dancing pit.
Oh, that's great.
Like, repeatedly. Yes.
There should always be one Doctor Who cosplayer at, like, a Renaissance fair who is just the Doctor.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, no, wait, do not do that. Isn't there a thing where Star Trek people do that? That's annoying as hell? Isn't it a thing?
Well, okay, when I go to the Ren Faire, I feel like it's kind of a free-for-all. Like, you can just dance, you can just dress up however you want. Like, there are a lot of people in that Renaissance period outfits, but I've seen like like the 11th Doctor and stuff like that. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not bothered by it, but I guess I could see the irritation.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna rock up to one as the 3rd Doctor and annoy everyone by acting like John Pertwee for like 2 hours, just poking holes at things and getting into fights. I don't know
where I heard this from. Yeah, it was just, I remember hearing about like people who dress up as like Enterprise crew members and go to Ren Faire and be like, oh, we are in the past because we're from the Enterprise.
So, I mean, if you are doing that, like, no offense, but I would wedgie you because that is just kind of silly. Talk about Creed. One last breath. One last time now for plugs. So, Shelby, if you have anything you want to plug, plug away.
Yeah, we finished recording our podcast about the X-Files, Condensed Truth, but I haven't edited it, but I'm sure it'll be out by the time this episode's out. So if you would like to listen to my podcast about the X-Files and hear me drone about the X-Files, check it out. Otherwise, you can find me at alphacouple.bsky.social on Blue Sky. I'm not really active on Twitter anymore, so, you know. Yeah, I've just been watching a lot of anime, so I assume by the time y'all follow me, I will still be tweeting about anime and manga, so.
Wait, I have a question for you, Shelby, which is, the question specifically is, what do you think of the Ryan Coogler reboot of X-Files? What do you think of that?
I'm kind of like cautiously optimistic. I definitely feel like it's a world where there's plenty of other stuff to talk about beyond Mulder and Scully. But I also feel like that's still a challenge because the show is so much about Mulder and Scully, like the myth arc and all that stuff. And just like why people watch it is like they're so compelling as a partnership. So I don't know, like, it's interesting. I watched part of the new Quantum Leap and bailed pretty early. But if they do the route that the new Quantum Leap did, it'll be bad.
Yeah.
So they need to not just like make it. I don't know. It's a tough thing to nail, I feel. But I think there's plenty of space for the X-Files in our current climate, obviously. But a lot of people will bitch and moan if you give like any conspiracies like air to breathe, so I can't guarantee they're just not going to get yelled at the entire time.
Honestly, I think more now than ever, there's time for the X-Files.
Exactly.
The X-Files, has become the Files, basically. Well, not really. Yeah. They were not jerks. There was that, I'm sorry, David, I know you're trying to wrap it up, but wasn't there like a, I remember like in 2020, they were like, we're going to do a comedy reboot where it's like...
It was an animated, shitty... yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
It was like... animated the one. And then Star Trek just took that idea. It was like, yeah. I think that's an avenue they could go... Honestly, if they were like, this is the shit, this is the underfunded X-Files office, and these two are a little bit funny, but they still were like telling just straightforward drama stories, I think you could do something like that. That would be... success, because that's what Lower Decks did.
Yeah.
As far as I can see, I haven't seen it, but as far as I know, it is basically a show that started off as like, we're comedy Star Trek, and people just tell me that it's like, yeah, it's Star Trek, but they tell more jokes than usual.
And I think animation would really benefit something like the X-Files, where you can kind of explore it in like it's just visually, you're going to be able to do more interesting things than just like cheap TV sci-fi or like a CGI kind of like right. stuff. So I wouldn't mind an animated thing, but yeah, I do. I think a lot of people weirdly blame the X-Files for our distrust in the American institutions. And I was like, they're just commenting on it. Like, it's not their fault. So I'm curious to how that will land. If Ryan Coogler's project does go forward, how that will land with the audience today, because I'm not really sure if the appetite is there, even though I feel like thematically and all that stuff, it's still a very important show that could tell us a lot about our current moment, but it's a tough needle to thread for sure.
Back to you, David.
Back to me. I don't know. Yeah, we're on Blue Sky as well. We're everywhere, you know. That's the problem. Because we're everywhere, we're subliminally, you know, underneath everything you're doing. Mm-hmm. We invented Skip the Toilet, for example. I don't know. Yeah. Have fun out there in the world. And if you see a silent, gun it down immediately.
You probably already have.
Your job as American, yeah.
Yeah, to shoot the silence. Do you think Nixon went to Henry, was like, Henry, Kissinger, we have to kill the silence. And Kissinger was like, I was already doing it.
I was already doing it.
Craziest thing. They're all in Laos for some reason.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.
Actually, one more thing. The guy who plays the doctor, not the doctor, the American army doctor, has a really great American doctor kind of vibe to him. As in, like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's got like the kind of, like, he's the kind of guy you cast as like an army doctor who gets confused by an alien. So good job for him. But yeah, without further ado, goodbye. One last breath, Creed. Bluegrass cover.
Next time on Pod Tour, who cast?
Yo ho ho!
Our sensors picked you up. Ship in distress.
It's dangerous here. There is a monster aboard. She leaves a mark on men's skin.
Doctor, what's happening to me?
You're stowaways.
Amy, what are you doing?
Saving your life. Okay with that, are you?
There's a stroppy, homicidal mermaid trying to kill us.
She's here.